ferry to get to a one-mile stretch of sand that didn't have restrooms, tables, or fresh water. It was the result of more than 30 years of beach segregation in Fort Lauderdale. But on the 4th of July of 1961, a handful of black activists stepped onto a whites-only beach and then waded into the Atlantic Ocean. That simple act brought lawsuits, police resistance, and death threats. But wade-ins continued, week after week, for 6 weeks, each time with more and more people. The city of Fort Lauderdale asked a judge to put an end to the protests. Instead, the judge ordered the end of beach segregation in Fort Lauderdale. Today, a plaque will be erected at the very spot of that first wade-in. For NPR News, I'm Kenny Malone in Miami.
And I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letton, and today we're in Austin, Texas. It's a beautiful afternoon, a little hot, but that just makes the bottle of cold Lone Star taste even better.
This old town's filled with sin. It'll swallow.
The city has a rep for being a laid-back, fun-loving place, but you don't have to be here long before you start to hear this.
Austin, the city, the physical city's changed dramatically. When we moved in here in 87, there weren't more than 7 high-rises in downtown. And now, you know, I don't know how many there are. I can see 7 or 8 out the window.
When I first moved here and I'd be downtown, you know, I would look east, I could see the sun rising and so on, and then in the evenings I'd still be at work and I'd look west and I could see the sunset, and there's no such thing anymore.
You know, it's like Rip Van Winkle. If you fell asleep here 35 years and woke up, you wouldn't even recognize the place. Literally, it's just so different.
And it's not just the landscape that's going through a makeover.
This is a region that is adding about 50,000 new people to its population every year.
Interesting note about Austin is that it has doubled in population every 25 years for 125 years.
When I moved here in 84, the population was 585,000, and now we're counting a little over 1.7 million. So tremendous growth.
Especially after the dot-com boom and bust, which really wasn't all that much of a bust for Austin because people started moving here.
And that's what a city wants. Progress, right? Well, Austin is not your typical city. And State of the Reunion isn't your typical show. Every episode, we do a deep dive into communities across America and tell stories about the people and their connection to the place they call home. We explore the things that bring communities together and the issues that pull them apart. Now, Austin is the capital of Texas, but it doesn't exactly square up with the rest of the state. Take, for example, Leslie.
Hi, this is Leslie Cochran of Austin, Texas. Now, you can ask anybody who the mayor is, and nobody can tell you who the mayor is. But you ask anybody who Leslie is, everybody knows me. I'm a good boomer.
Leslie is a sweet guy. He's the salt of the earth, and he's more than a little recognizable. Today, he's wearing a belly shirt and a leopard print skirt, and he likes to wear thongs in public places. Now, lots of cities have eccentric residents, but in Austin, a guy like Leslie is celebrated.
The people here really adopted to me, and I became an instant celebrity in my thong in the 6th Street.
How many times did you run for mayor?
I ran 3 times. Twice one term because the guy that beat me quit. And so they had to have a special election. Then I ran for the next term. And I love Austin, I love the people. And I wasn't a politician running for whatever. I just wanted to keep Austin, Austin.
This is a city where a guy in a thong can get a substantial percentage of the vote. And he's not alone. There's a whole collection of characters.
I used to have a friend named Thomas B. And he supposedly pawned his teeth so he could get money for beer, you know? That's weird, you know?
I'm Crazy Carl. I'm very pleased you met me. I moved here, and then the first day I went out there on the street, I started balancing a carnation on the palm of my hand. And it spun. I said, whoa. And 2 weeks later, I couldn't go anyplace in Austin without somebody saying, you're the guy that spins the flower. Highly overpriced flowers probably die before you get home.
I had a hot pink art car with pigs painted down the side, a big wheelbarrow on the top with another big giant pig in it. I mean, everybody would love a car with pigs painted down the side and pig ornaments all over the car, hot pink. Who wouldn't like it?
I wrote a column one time about a guy, and his claim to fame was he could chew the top off a beer can. Not the pop top, but the entire top.
See what I mean? That kind of stuff might happen in L.A., San Francisco, or New York City, but in Red State, Texas? So how did this happen? Well, part of the answer lies in this being a college town, home of the University of Texas, hook 'em horns. And the other part has to do with a problem that needed solving a few decades ago.
We had no place to play. I mean, there was nothing going on here. We had two or three country dance halls on the edges of town. Dull and boring and you know, just the worst.
Back in 1970, Eddie Wilson looked to solve that problem by starting a club that's become infamous in Austin lore, Armadillo World Headquarters.
Armadillo is a very special creature. It looks like a monster. It shares its home with others. It lives underground. All of the symbology was perfect for the hippie. Considered ugly. You know, everything about the Armadillo was a perfect reflection of what was considered the hippie movement. I was called a guru. I was called a guru of the Armadillo cult in Women's Wear Daily.
Eddie started booking bands at the Armadillo, and they had everyone from Jerry Garcia to Etta James to a then-unknown Bruce Springsteen. People poured into Austin, and the music hall became the epicenter of the hippie universe in Texas.
The reason we had so many hippie musicians come here in such a big hurry from Houston and Dallas and all those places was that they're the first guys to grow out their hair in high school back in those days, and they get their ass kicked, and they hear that there's a bunch of hippies in Austin, and so maybe there's strength in numbers. And we had $40 rent houses all over South Austin in spitting distance of the Armadillo, and they were all of a sudden filled up with mattresses that should have been taken to the dump. And we've got a whole new community moving here to get some sort of protection from the kind of rednecks back home.
And then one night, Eddie booked Willie Nelson to play, and both hippies and rednecks showed up.
Whiskey River, take my mind.
The hippie chicks pulled it off for us. You know, as soon as the rednecks saw the women that we were hanging out with, they started missing haircuts just immediately. And the hippies were already using cowboy hats to hide their long hair. And so just all of a sudden, there was a blurring of the line.
And even though the Armadillo closed in 1980, it had made its mark. Austin gained a reputation as the live music capital of the world, a town of tolerance, of great music and good times. It began to fill up with musicians and artists, and then, beginning in the 1990s, things started to change. A different breed of newcomers began to call the city home.
People relocated to Austin because they knew they could sell their homes out on the West Coast or in D.C. or in Chicago or New York, move to Austin, buy a house, and have money left over to start their own tech-related or other creative-related enterprise.
That's Josh Long, who wrote a book about Austin called Weird City. As the tech industry has grown, the city's become more attractive to a wider range of people than just the funky artistic folks.
And when you started getting all these groups, you had a new bringing in of all these different populations to Austin, and there was an awful lot of concern that things were getting far too associated with money and consumerism, that when other people came in, they expected the same sort of consumer landscapes that they had back home. And so anytime you have a lot of money coming into a town, a lot of new people coming into town willing to spend that money, you're going to see the landscape change.
A glance at the skyline of downtown Austin says it all. I've been here before. Last time was in 98. And so I thought I knew what the city looked like, but this trip I was amazed at how many condos and high-rise buildings have gone up, even despite an economic recession. And that's made some Austinites nervous.
I think when it started becoming more entrepreneurial and big businesses started moving in, that's when I started getting worried about the weirdness disappearing.
Red Wasinick is a lifelong Austinite. Back in 2000, he sort of stumbled into founding what's become a movement in Austin.
I was making a contribution to a odd local community radio show, and the person taking the money said, "So why are you donating to this show?" And I said, "Oh, it helps keep Austin weird." And the phrase kind of resonated with me, and I mentioned it to my wife, And she said, well, let's get some bumper stickers.
Now, that phrase that Red came up with might have just died out if it weren't for what happened soon afterwards.
I'm John T. Kuntz, the owner and president of Waterloo Records and Video.
Yeah, I'm Steve Berkew, a co-owner of Book People, and I operate the store here in 6th and Lamar.
And you could say that this intersection is sort of a cultural hub for the city. Book People is a huge multi-story independent bookstore on one corner. And just across the street is Waterloo Records, an independent record store where they host live in-store performances. And the Clerks are the biggest music nuts in town. So a few years ago, John and Steven heard a rumor about a Borders Books and Music coming to a corner just opposite of them.
It was about 300 to 400 feet from our doors. So we started trying to think about, you know, what to do about it.
They didn't mind having a competitor. What got them was that the city was going to give the developer millions of dollars in incentives to build the Borders. Steve and John knew they needed to rally the community, and at first they tried their email lists. Then they hired an economic analyst named Dan Houston to do the math.
And that's how we ended up with this notion of, let's see what happens to $100 that goes in the door here at Book People or at the Borders. And we ended up with, I think, three times as much money recirculates locally in this locally owned store, and it's true of both of these, the books and music here, compared to what would recirculate locally at the Borders.
But even with those hard numbers, they realized their message still hadn't found its voice. Then one day, Steve ran across some bumper stickers one of his customers, Red Wasenick, had dropped off at his store.
And I said, you know, John, why don't we put Keep Austin Weird on a bumper sticker with both our logos, and because we're not partners or something, you know, so people can figure out why our logos are on this, we'll put support local businesses on the bottom, and we'll just give them away. We talked about it a little bit, and we reluctantly, you know, decided to get 5,000 of them and split them, $2,500 each, and give them away and see if anybody wanted. About 10 days later, John calls me up and says, you got any more of those bumper stickers? And I said, I don't know. You know, so I go downstairs here, because my office is upstairs, and I look, and we don't have any more either. We're out. We're both out. We're out of 5,000 of these things, and it's been like 10 days or something. They're gone.
At this point, they've given away more than 250,000 of those bumper stickers, and the Keep Austin Weird logo is everywhere. T-shirts, baseball caps, you name it.
It caught on. It's a big deal. It has become, as far as we can tell, the city motto. You know, we just did that as a
part of an awareness campaign everybody in Austin about, you know, hey, think about some of the choices that you make when you go out to buy whatever it is you need.
Steve and John won the battle with Borders. The developers decided to abandon their plans for the store, and Keep Austin Weird became more than just a celebration of eccentricity or a clever way of saying buy local. It became an anthem for a whole movement of Austinites passionate about their city. Coming up next, residents pump up the volume on efforts to protect one of the city's prized communities, its music makers. That's ahead on State of the Reunion.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and today we're in Austin, Texas, a city that's trying to hold on to a sense of self amid an explosion of growth. Now, in recent years, there have been a whole series of David versus Goliath battles, as longtime residents have tried to keep it weird by fighting an onslaught of big chain stores. Sometimes there have been clear victories, and sometimes an Austin-style compromise.
It was in the Austin American Statesman, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. It was such a stark change in our area, which was already having problems with traffic and crime.
Jason Meeker moved to Austin in the 80s to go to the University of Texas and has been in love with the city ever since. That day, he opened the newspaper and saw the good news that Walmart would be moving into the neighborhood.
The push from the business interests behind it, developers, was that it was a done deal. Done. Announced Walmart, we're going to build it. And reflexively, that doesn't jibe with me. You can't tell me that it's a done deal. Nothing's a done deal, and especially not in my neighborhood.
Now, in some places, a new Walmart would be welcome. New business, new taxes to the city, development on a property that was becoming kind of an eyesore. But this community in Austin saw it differently. Kat Correa had lived in the neighborhood for 20 years.
Never really got out there and did a bunch of community stuff, but as soon as I saw a Walmart sign, I was really concerned and I wondered, I need to go find out about this and see what I can do. And I just dove headfirst into this cause and, you know, met tremendous people, and I'm here to stay as well.
The developer held a community meeting to inform the public of their plans. Jason, Kat, and many other people from the area showed up.
They explain what it is. It's not just a Walmart. It's a Walmart that's going to be 225,000 square feet. It's going to be two stories with a three-story parking garage. If you calculate the square footage inside Texas Stadium over there at University of Texas, that's roughly the same size. And the gasp in the room was really something. And I think from then on, it was game on.
To Jason, it was like the Death Star was moving into the orbit of their little neighborhood. And what's the Death Star without the Rebel Alliance to fight it? The community began to organize to stop what they saw as a monstrosity that would forever change their neighborhood. They called their group Responsible Growth for North Cross, or RG4N. Now, these people didn't consider themselves activists. They were software developers, accountants, piano teachers, small business owners. But this was a fight they weren't backing down from. The first action? Handing out bright red lawn signs that read No Walmart. The little signs could be seen from hundreds of feet away.
There were just these initial red signs started just spiking up everywhere in people's yards.
The next step was forcing their way onto the agenda of city council meetings, making the politicians take notice. But that wasn't enough. They needed a way to gain more attention.
The idea came to us that we should form a human chain around the North Cross property, which is roughly a square mile.
The idea was the physical manifestation of the community's resistance to Walmart, to actually show people how large the complex would be. This was a risk for RG4N. If people didn't show up, they'd look like a small group of dissenters, not a community against a developer.
February 10th was a very cold day. It was 40 degrees. Very, very cold day Saturday morning. And we got there, and we were all wearing red, and we had people at different positions all around the property, and it was looking sparse.
I remember calling people in my neighborhood the night before that I knew had big families to say, please show up.
It's 9:30 and no one's showing up. It's 9:45 and they're starting to show up a little bit. And then right between 9:45 and 10 o'clock, they start coming. They're walking.
With babies, you know, and strollers and 2 and 3 year olds, you know, dragging them down the street. Lots of kids rode their little tricycles and bicycles, you know, when their parents were walking. So it was a beautiful event. It was awesome.
We filled the entire perimeter. People locked arm in arm, hand in hand, a square mile around the property.
Nobody wanted to go home. We were getting honked at by the cars. People were clapping and cheering. They brought their dogs
and
with red bandanas
and strollers.
And it was such a great time, and nobody wanted to go home. You kind of forgot about being cold.
It was a beautiful moment. The high of that day lasted a while, but it didn't seem to make a difference to the developer, who was still moving forward with plans for Walmart. Next step, the courts. The group filed a lawsuit against the city and the developer, Lincoln Properties, claiming that Austin broke several laws in granting a site permit for the Walmart, including the ones that protected trees, limited runoff, and regulated traffic. Linda Huff is a member of RG4N.
The last day of the trial, the lawyers on the other side congratulated our lawyers. They thought that we had won. Seriously. I mean, the case was great. I was there every day, you know, for the trial. And it was so wonderful. I mean, we really felt like we had a chance here.
They waited for the verdict, feeling pretty confident the decision would go their way, until Kat got an email.
And the subject sign said, well, we lost. And I just burst into tears.
It was a Christmas present, a real bad one. It was right before Christmas. The judge didn't even respond to our case really in any great detail. She just said no.
But even that didn't stop this group.
It was still big, and we kept saying, but that's not good enough. We kept saying, what about security? What are you going to do about crime? What about light pollution and you know, trash pollution? And what else are you going to do for us? If you're going to be here, how are you going to be a good neighbor? And we kept working.
When something like this happens, these long, protracted fights over the soul of a neighborhood, the people involved with it tend to become consumed. I've seen it all over the country, from Brooklyn, New York, to New Orleans, Louisiana, to right here in Austin, Texas. It just becomes a part of your daily life, and that's how Jason felt. Then, one day, several years into the fight, out of the blue, he got a call from a reporter asking him what he thought about the developer's decision on Walmart.
I said, let me call our attorney, I'll call you back.
The developer had announced that they were scaling down the project considerably.
Less than half.
Yes.
And this had never happened anywhere.
Anywhere.
And I was giddy. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And I remember the reaction from a lot of the news stations was sort of, okay, they changed the size again. No, you don't understand. They changed the size, like, significantly. It's going to be much smaller. This is a big deal. This is the end of the fight.
Standing in the parking lot overlooking the construction, you can see the difference between what was proposed and what they're building now.
Well, I think that's what's really important is that because of our pushback and all of our efforts, consistent efforts, Walmart went back and redesigned, and this is their first urban design. And it's not a big gray box. It has some different design elements. It's not all going to be brick. There's different materials. There's outdoor seating. And I guess if it's possible, it's a kinder, gentler Walmart.
Now, the developers say the downturn in the economy was the reason for downsizing the Walmart. And RG4N admits that probably had something to do with it. But whatever the reason, the members of this community are happy. It's a compromise, a truce between the idea of what Austin is in many people's minds and the future that's knocking on the door. Development is changing almost every part of Austin. It's even having an impact on what the city is most famous for, the live music scene. Right now, we're standing outside of the Mohawk Nightclub. Its owner, James Moody, says if Austin is known as the live music capital of the world, then this street, Red River, is its main street.
One of the single greatest music streets in the United States, if not the world. It is a continuous sort of live music street. It's the only place in Austin where you can park your car, not move your car, and see five shows in one night. You know, you can see some garage rock stuff at Red 7. I live in a graveyard. You can see rockabilly stuff at Beerland. And then you can see an indie show here at the Mohawk. You can see a singer-songwriter show at Club DeVille next door, it's all right next to each other. And you can get a slice of pizza or a hot dog and not have to leave.
But Red River is also in the middle of downtown Austin. Condos have been springing up in this part of town faster than you can count them. A case in point, a fancy new development that's just opened directly across the street from Moody's Club.
They're surrounded by, I mean, they are in the virtual epicenter of the live music capital of the world, but also the loudest street in the live music capital of the world, and they dropped an apartment complex in there. But it's a fantastic case study because when they're coming out of the dirt, I started meeting with them, as opposed to getting my shotgun out and saying, we're going to blast some rock and roll as soon as you move those people in there, and we're going to fight the city hall. It was more like, no, do you guys realize where you're building? And if you want to be successful, because clearly you've already borrowed the money, you know, the bricks are coming up, let's talk about your marketing plan, and let's market to people that are really into live music. So heaven forbid my Aunt Kathy moves in there to think it's going to be, you know, the Palace of Serenity, and it's not.
Moody says, to their credit, the developers have edited their marketing plan and added extra thick glass to bedroom windows and partnered with Mohawk to build a sound-reducing wall around the club. But this highlights a problem that's surfacing in the city. With all this change, this progress, Moody's worried that one of the things that draws people here, the live music scene, risks being forgotten in the mix.
You know, sometimes it's like, oh, the kids, they'll just organically find their next home, you know? They'll just always find a place to do the rock and roll. Well, the city's growing so fast. This is a precious urban core. You know, to push music further and further out of the core doesn't do the right thing for the... I keep going back to the same thing. It's the live music capital of the world. So if we didn't say that, if that wasn't our marketing message to the rest of the world, maybe I don't have a story. But if we say we're the cheese capital of the world, we need to protect our cheese.
And protecting the cheese means protecting the cheese makers.
Artists, venue owners, booking agents, engineers, producers.
Paula Vasey owns Momo's Club.
I mean, everybody that even dabbles in music, we want to organize. And it's not couched in negativity or for a cause. I mean, it's fun is kind of the underlying theme, but also it is a statement to City Hall that, you know, here are our numbers.
And Austin city leaders have begun to listen. A couple years ago, they founded the Live Music Task Force to try and take on issues brought on by gentrification. As a result of that, they hired a liaison between City Hall and the music industry. But government can only do so much. The cost of living has kept rising, making it harder and harder for musicians to afford living here. When they struggle to pay rent, things like healthcare get pushed to the side. But there's one group that aims to fix that. We're in what looks like a typical dentist examination room. But the guy in the chair getting his teeth cleaned, he's wearing sunglasses. Nigerian-born musician Kalu James prefers to keep his shades on when he's getting dental work done.
You okay?
Yeah. I'm beginning to love the taste of that water.
Floss in between your teeth.
Kalu is here getting his teeth cleaned because of HAM. That stands for Health Alliance for Austin Musicians.
Figuring out how to keep the car running and keep the bills not piling up and rent going, so dental ends up becoming the back burner, as well as other medical stuff, which is really bad. So HAM plays a huge role for my colleagues and I here in Austin.
The dental office that Kalu is visiting today, it's actually a mobile RV unit, a big trailer that's been specially outfitted to have a full dental exam room inside. It's run by the St. David's Foundation. Most of the year, these vans are used to keep school children's teeth clean. But HAM worked with St. David's to make them available to Austin musicians when school's out during the summer months.
We make the musicians go to the medical clinic once a year for a checkup. The dental van is doing preventive care. They're doing things like cleanings and taking x-rays and giving full exams. But the idea is if you can keep your teeth clean, you're not going to need some of that major work. And, you know, for healthcare, the musicians were using the wait and see, let's just wait it out kind of attitude. But eventually, if you really have a serious medical problem, you're going to go to the emergency room.
That's Carolyn Schwartz, HAM's executive director. She's the one musicians call when they want to join the program.
The musician needs to be living at 250% of the poverty line, which is about $27,000 a year. Although the majority of our, and right now we're seeing about 1,400 active, the majority earn about 150% of poverty, which is $16,000 a year.
This is not free healthcare. It's a discount program that makes it affordable for musicians to see a doctor. By partnering with other organizations that offer reduced price services, HAM pulls together a complete package for musicians. Annual checkups, dental, vision, hearing, even mental health care.
I miss the world of love. I knew when I was younger.
Nakia is a blues and soul singer who's lived in Austin since 2002. He says this program literally saved his life when he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder after attempting suicide. Before HAM, he basically had to go to a local clinic and beg for treatment.
There's a certain amount of shame and stigma that already comes with having mental health issues. And then to look at it from a perspective of someone who is poor and can't afford just basic health insurance, You're going out and you're essentially begging for these things. And most people I know I was raised in a little town in Alabama, it's not polite to beg. And so it was really difficult for me. I mean, I had to swallow a lot of pride.
But HAM and their mental health partner, the Sims Foundation, changed that. Just days after signing up, he had an appointment with a psychiatric nurse, and he was on medication within a week. He says knowing he has the support he needs to be healthy has changed his life.
As a musician, one of the things that I think is really key is knowing that you can be happy and be creative. You know, you can be happy and be successful. I've never been more happy than I am in my life now, even when the bad stuff comes, because, you know, life isn't going to change. Things are still going to come at you. But I have the tools available to me and the resources available to me to help me get through it and people to turn to, as opposed to just being out in a sea of loneliness and emptiness, you know, without those things.
When you're down and feeling low, and this world holds no promise, there ain't no place left for you to go.
As a social worker, it's so rewarding to get thank you notes and emails that tell me how much people, the musicians, appreciate what we've done here. I get to see on a day-to-day basis how lives are being changed, how families are changing, how careers are being saved, because the musicians now have peace of mind. They have access to something that they never thought would be accessible to them.
All over the country, people are moving into areas where artists hang out. They make the place cool, give an area a vibe that's lacking in many locations, the creative capital of a city, so to speak. But once people get there, they tend to forget what attracted them in the first place. Suddenly, condos are popping up, rents begin to rise, and the artists that made the place attractive are pushed to the side. Now, Austin hasn't solved all the problems that are affecting their community of musicians, but they are engaging with them, looking for ways to keep the music playing in the live music capital of the world. Coming up, a new kind of Austin entrepreneur, one that is found in a trailer park.
So I opened a trailer that did s'mores. And it was great because I would sit and work on my books in my trailer and sell marshmallows. And it was a way of making a living as a writer. And it was great.
That's ahead on State of the Reunion. Support for State of the Reunion comes from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a network of listeners, producers, and stations working to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education, providing for musicians of all ages in over 200 school music programs. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and today we're in Austin, Texas, and this, Well, this is the part of the show where I start getting hungry.
Green chili queso. You got to try some queso. All
right.
The green chili pork's really good.
Yeah.
The Baja shrimp, I love.
All this hour, we've been talking about how Austin's rapid growth has been impacting the city and its culture, whether Austin can stay weird. Now, the one thing that's been growing even faster than the high-rises in the city's downtown is the number of restaurants operating out of little trailers.
It is a hot day in Austin, Texas, and I am sitting under an umbrella at a trailer park that serves food, and I'm at Torchy's Tacos. Damn good! And I'm getting ready to bite into my first Torchy's.
Torchy's trailer is like an old-school Airstream, outfitted to serve gourmet tacos. Owner Michael Ripka was a corporate chef for more than a decade and wanted to open his own restaurant, but didn't have the money to do so. A trailer, though, he could do that for a fraction of the price.
You know, we opened the doors. We were kind of in a hidden spot on 5th and Baylor, and nobody really knew we were there, so we started delivering tacos. I went out and handed out free chips and salsa to everybody, and you know, really, it's just been word of mouth. You know, we got our tagline, Damn Good Tacos, from when people literally would come up and say, damn, these tacos are good. Damn, these tacos are good. And that's how we added that to our logo.
Yeah, all you listeners in Radioland, I can tell you that they aren't just good. They're amazing. Now, I'm used to a tortilla with a little ground beef, some sauce, and that's about it. But these tacos are works of art. They've got fried avocado tacos, green chili pork tacos, Baja shrimp tacos. I could go on. So this is the part of the show where I get to eat, and you get to be jealous, but it's okay. I forgive you. I forgive you. Torchy's first trailer was so successful that they added a second, and that got so popular. They built a brick-and-mortar location, and, well, other would-be restaurateurs took note.
I mean, we probably get 20 calls a week still of people wanting to know what we did and how we did it, and it's been a trip watching kind of how it's all exploded. I mean, it's really, you know, people realize, wow, you can start something from that small and grow it into something.
Now, taco trucks have been around in a lot of cities for a long time, but Austin has taken the food trailer to new heights. Anything you can imagine eating is sold out of a trailer here.
I'm Becca Strong. I'm Zoya Ulesso. And you're at Iggy's Texitarian Cuisine.
So what is Texitarian? I've never heard of that before.
Southern-style vegan food. My parents are reigning champs at the Lone Star Vegetarian Chili Cook-Off, and so we do...
I'm Jeff Schaefer. This is Tyler Johnson. We're the owners of Along Came a Slider.
One of them's going to be a achiote duck confit. We're also going to do a pork belly, a espresso rub brisket. We'll do a Kobe beef slider, a vegetarian black bean burger.
You guys are making my mouth water.
But our most prestigious item is obviously our barbecue brisket. It's all slow smoked for about 24 hours on a slow, colder smoke. And whenever I say colder smoke, about 180 degrees.
You can get crepes, cupcakes, upscale Indian food, fancy lattes.
I think what Austin did is it realized, wait, we could open a restaurant on four wheels, try it out, and start, you know, small and test the waters.
That's Josh Frank. He started a trailer a couple years ago called Treats that sold all the ingredients for gourmet s'mores and had a little campfire where people could toast their marshmallows.
At the time that I opened mine, there was Torchy's and Hey Cupcake, and there was Flip Happy Crepes and maybe one or two others. Then within 6 months, there was 20 or 30, and within the last 12 months, there's hundreds.
All those new food trailers gave Josh an idea, an official restaurant trailer park. And that evolved into EAT, East Austin Trailer Eatery, which has transformed this vacant lot. I'm 5 minutes with Josh, and you realize that he's the type of guy who's always thinking, always connecting the dots, and then going one step further. To that end, he's opened an arts complex in a formerly abandoned building next to the trailer park. Artists rent studio space and sell their work, and people coming for the food trailers can walk through and see the art.
People like that whole thing of, like, I went and ate dinner in a trailer, and I bought this art. It's like a story, you know? It's like, I think it sort of activates the art as well. It's like, I bought art at a trailer park eatery, you know, in this building that had flamingos. You know, it's like, I'm going to go eat where the art is.
And other folks have pushed the trailer envelope even further.
We had to be really careful when we decided to do the whole trailer thing.
We didn't want people to look at us like, whoa, what is this, two yahoos in a trailer? You know, what am I getting here?
Tony Lopez and Chad Swisher opened up an advertising agency out of Chad's baby blue trailer called Big Blue Sky Creative. Now, it's one thing to buy a taco from a trailer, and another to buy thousands of dollars worth of advertising. But Chad and Tony say they've worked it into their brand.
What's great about Austin is that we kind of mentioned it as a joke to some friends, and they're like, I think that'd be awesome. That'd be cool. You guys could travel and take it to clients, and, you know, you could set up places like, you know, this campground and meet with people. And we're like, yeah, maybe so. And then we started kind of bouncing around for a couple of months and just said, let's do it. And, you know, that I think a lot of cities, if we had done that, we would have been nervous. Like, oh, what are people going to think? Are they going to make fun of us? They're going to call us rednecks or whatever. But Austin's been great. People have welcomed it. If anything, we've heard from friends that have other shops. They're like, why didn't we think of that?
This trailer phenomenon, it just feels right in Austin. It's the organic growth that springs out of soil fertilized with creativity. And while there's plenty of corporate expansion, chain stores, condos, and so forth, these entrepreneurs are putting their own weird spin on establishing a business. If you go to stateoftheunion.com, we have a short video documentary where you can actually see these trailers in all their varieties. Every city or town State of the Reunion visits, we ask people to write a letter to their home expressing how they feel about it. This one's from Chad Swisher of Big Blue Sky Creative.
Dear Austin, you're not my city, you're not my town, you're my summer camp. You wake me up each morning with a bounding energy to see what you have in store for me. You fill my days with canoeing on the lake, swimming in the springs, and laughing with my friends around a backyard fire. You provide me trails to get from activity to activity and play me music every night. You inspire me to learn, to create, to dance, to run, to play. And you put me to bed each evening with a sunburn, mosquito bites, and a huge smile on my face, ready to pop up the next day and do it all over again. But you don't just make me feel like a kid again. You constantly, magically, make me think like a kid again. You remind me what matters. The size of my house? Nah, you don't really care. Besides, what kid stays in his cabin all day when there's a whole summer camp out there? You don't even care about the car I drive. As long as it will carry a kayak and dog hair isn't too difficult to clean out of it, you give it your high recommendation. You remind me of the absolute joy of being myself, of that impenetrable nonchalance we had as children. When we didn't care what swimsuit we were wearing, who saw us belly flop, or what they thought about it, we were having fun, and fun was paramount. You remind me to be inspired. You give me a renewed ignorance of the impossible. You tear apart the rulebook that, for some reason, adults all write for themselves, and replace it with an assurance that no matter how crazy, strange, or odd your little campers want to be, you'll embrace us. A year ago, you even let me start my business in a trailer. Other cities would have judged me for this, laughed at me even, but you didn't either. You smiled, waved me over, and considered it one more addition to your fun, weird, inspiring little summer camp. Thank you, Austin. Chad Swisher.
One of the more magical things in Austin is tucked away in a residential neighborhood south of downtown. What I'm seeing in this backyard, it's a little hard to describe. It's a towering two-story structure made out of material that most people would just throw away. Metal, wire, and concrete wrap around each other to make a sculpture unlike anything I've seen before. Old car parts, skis, wires, shoes, shopping carts, and a million other odds and ends are all puzzled together into a cathedral. The man behind it is Vince Hanneman.
I've been playing in the backyard since I was a kid. This is just playing. This is just fort building. What I really like about the junk is that it's free. It's good looking to me, too. There's a lot of good stuff, and it's just a shame what people throw away sometimes.
Vince started building the Cathedral of Junk 21 years ago, and little by little, people started to hear about it.
After about the third year in, people started realizing what I was doing, and they started bringing me stuff. So for the last 17 years or whatever, it's all been donations. And if it doesn't show up in the driveway, forget it. You know, a dozen skis or whatever, all kinds of good stuff in the driveway, you know, an engine block or something, you know, and then people would be like, did you get that stuff I left? It's like, well, which stuff was that exactly?
Over the years, the Cathedral of Junk has become an Austin icon, People got married in it. Visitors came from all over the globe. That is, until last March, when city code enforcement knocked on his door.
And said that they had got a complaint, which is not unusual. I've been complained on since the third year in. But the difference this time is that code asked me to get a building permit and a certificate of occupancy. It's a residential neighborhood, and so they say I'm not zoned for this, to have this. They wanted to say it was an entertainment venue because of the weddings and the birthday parties I have here.
That visit from code enforcement inspired a flurry of activity. There were efforts at negotiating with the city. Visitors were banned from Vince's property, and he was threatened with fines in civil court. So, for months now, Vince has been slowly deconstructing the cathedral, basically subdividing it into individual pieces.
Because I crossed the line from yard art to building at some point. I don't know what point that was exactly. So I just thought, well, I'll just cross the line back the other way and make it back into yard art again.
Vince says that all of this is happening now because all of a sudden his neighborhood has become a hot commodity on the real estate market.
This part of town used to be called Bubble Land. Now they want to, you know, give it some fancy name. The minute it becomes valuable in a real estate way, then suddenly they're interested in safety and code enforcement and all this stuff.
As of the end of the summer, Vince and the city were still working to find a solution that would allow him to open the cathedral again to visitors. Austin Mayor Lee Leffingwell told us that the Cathedral of Junk is uniquely Austin, and he trusts that they will find a way to preserve it while at the same time doing what they have to do as a city to ensure the safety of visitors. In the meantime, deconstruction continues.
I've been working over here. This is my latest little slice through the cathedral. This used to be a wall here, and I've been dissecting it. So now this throne and the back of the throne area, this is its own sculpture now. It's under 200 feet.
Bringing down the cathedral has inspired a whole team of volunteers to come help Vince. And while he's grateful for their assistance, you can feel it weighing on him, this daily practice of taking down what he spent his life building.
Now, I mean, this is not the cathedral anymore. This is the ruins of the cathedral.
Is it hard for you to come out here now that you've had
Very hard. It's very hard to talk about it. And it's like a bad dream in a lot of ways.
In some ways, this cathedral coming down is a metaphor for the tension we've been talking about this entire hour, the constant push and pull between the old Austin and this new up-and-coming city that's taking shape. And as this plays out, what once was gets lost in translation. And for Vince, that includes the Keep Austin Weird slogan.
I have no idea what that means anymore, if it ever did mean anything.
But this clearly is a part of the Keep Austin Weird concept.
It is. But I mean, having a bumper sticker and giving it lip service is one thing. They should be here saving it, and they're not.
Everyone has an opinion about what Keep Austin Weird actually means now, especially Red Wassenich, who initially came up with the phrase. A couple years ago, a marketing company that makes t-shirts and tchotchkes copyrighted the phrase, despite the fact that Red deliberately left it in the public domain.
It kind of seemed like a step in the whole process that I was objecting to. Is Austin was becoming more materialistic and commercial. That just seemed like another element of it, which was an irony I didn't appreciate.
It's an irony that Andrew Alleman also noticed. He moved to Austin in 1995 and works in the tech industry. About 5 years ago, he got fed up with the whole slogan, so Andrew came up with a website, Make Austin Normal. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely.
What you have in Austin, you have these warring factions, the ones that want, you know, hey, develop at any cost, and then the ones that want to keep it completely like it was. Don't develop. Don't build a road out to the suburbs because then people will move there, which people are going to move there anyway, right? So we're just behind.
To Andrew, Austin can't fight suburban sprawl without building up urban density, condos in the downtown, and the city can't embrace the newcomers that are keeping it a vibrant and exciting place to live without getting a little flexible on what it allows in. There's a lot of hypocrisy in the constant cries of keep it weird.
I was walking through a store a few years ago with one of my satirical shirts, which was Make Austin Normal, shop at big box stores, right? And this guy who is kind of had a hippie look to him and stuff was walking around with his girlfriend. He made some snide comment about my T-shirt. Well, the store we were in was Target, you know. So this guy's shopping in Target, yet he wants to be weird, right? He wants to shop local, but you know, sometimes you can't, right?
As far as Andrew and many other people we spoke to are concerned, Austin should be able to keep it both weird and growing.
Even if you get rid of a lot of the weird aspects here, and they're not going to go away, it's still going to be a lot of live music, a lot of artists. And I don't think those people are going to suddenly pack up and leave and go to the next quote-unquote weird city. I think we'll manage to retain enough of that character for a long time.
Now, Austin is a unique city. But it may come as a surprise to you that after getting to know the place through these stories, I don't know if I would call it weird. Absolutely, there are some weird things here, but to me, it just feels like, Austin. Like, this is exactly what it's supposed to be, where it's supposed to be. From Leslie, the cross-dressing mayoral candidate, to the food trailers, to the Cathedral of Junk, if I saw that in any other place, I'd think, yeah, that's weird. But here, well, it fits. But that's just me. I mean, I think everybody has their own definition of weirdness. And in Austin, it's tied to people's sense of place, what they love about the city. Some look at all the growth popping up around town and think that that weirdness, that special magic that can only be found in Austin, is endangered. And others see the same changes and think it's going to be just fine.
Austin is gone from little kid to like teenager with a Camaro to as an adult, maybe with a Volvo. I don't know. Vintage Volvo? Vintage orange Volvo.
When it comes to growth, you might as well try to fight gravity. In a capitalistic free society, attractive cities attract people.
It's kind of like people trampling the daisies to pick them, you know? It's like, yes, there's daisies here, and some of them are a lot flatter than they used to be, and there's a lot fewer of them, but you know, we can't expect that everybody will get to pick daisies without planting anymore.
There is a big segment here of people who are very accepting of the diverse kinds of people that we have and the different little quirks they have. And I think other people are quite disgusted with it and would like it to be a lot more homogenized and everyone would be like them.
I think Austin's going to be weird in 20 years because I'll still be here riding my midget pony and clown makeup. As long as... You know, if this group of people stay here, we're going to keep it going because that's what we do. You know, what else do we do?
Austin Growing Pains was produced by Tina Antolini, with help on the research front by Marietta Sinodis and business manager Bree Burge. Our senior editor is Taki Telenidis. The rest of the So True staff are producers Zach Rosen, Brenton Crozier, and Ian D'Souza is our Samurai of Soul. Special thank yous to Sam Patlove. Remember, you can see more of Austin and the other places we've gone at stateoftherunion.com. So True is distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Letson, and remember, things fall apart. Our job is to bring them back together.
There's a little bit of everything in Texas. Just look around and you will see.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. Kaufman, the Foundation for Entrepreneurship, supporting the entrepreneurs movement. Learn more at buildastrongeramerica.com. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, growing up in East Texas with a father who drank too much and a mother who spoke in tongues. Country music singer and songwriter Rodney Crowell brings his guitar and performs songs that relate to his new memoir, China Berry Sidewalks. Join us.
I could shed my skin and in the blink of an eye, I could fly, fly, fly.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Champaign County Forest Preserve District, presenting Second Sunday Music Performances at Lake of the Woods Forest Preserve in Mahomet. Sunday, July 10th, in the Mabry Galvin Botanical Garden, it's The Sounds of Rock by local band Suspicious Activity. Information at 586-2612 or at ccfpd.org.
Increasing clouds around Champaign-Urbana this afternoon. A chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high 85. Partly cloudy tonight, the low 62. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 88. Partly cloudy tomorrow night, the low 68. Partly sunny Wednesday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high 88. Wednesday night through Friday night, partly cloudy skies with a low of 65, the high 82 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.